This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 290 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm David Vanderhoof in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Max, welcome home. We've got a lot to talk about tonight. We sent you off on your first UAS convention, and we're not going to really do any news, but you've got a lot of news to cover. And should we get started?
Yes, let's get started, David.
So, Max, you went to Baltimore and you didn't go for Charm City Cakes. You went for UAVs and the FAA. So, how was the trip?
It was great. I tell you, I attended the FAA UAS Symposium, as you say, in Baltimore at the Convention Center, which is a great venue, by the way. I heard a couple of numbers about attendance. One was 1,100, one was 1,200. There were certainly a lot of people there. A lot of FAA employees there as well. They were really out in force. And I have some observations, I think, David, and maybe some topics that we can discuss a little. But first, just some overall impressions. I was quite impressed with the level of professionalism from the FAA. These were very bright people, very intelligent, very committed. They knew what the goals were, and just an amazingly professional group. I was just really amazed. And that applies to all levels of FAA employees, and really all levels of the organization were represented. So that was very impressive. I heard a quote from one person said, "Boy, this isn't my grandfather's FAA anymore." And it really isn't. They are really strongly committed to working with industry to solve some of these difficult problems that we have if we want to grow this industry. There were a number of safety professionals there, public safety professionals. And in fact, in and amongst the sessions, they had some indicated with a little special symbol as being of particular interest to folks who do public safety. And there were quite a number of sessions on that topic, and quite a lot of people attended those sessions. I did a couple of them because I was curious to find out, to learn what I didn't know. And I learned quite a bit. That's another observation. They also held, in addition to the longer formal sessions, some smaller 30-minute how-to sessions. Now, these ran concurrently, but they were designed for smaller groups of people that could focus on more kind of, you know, how-to, kind of hands-on kinds of issues, which was really great. But another kind of overall theme that kind of permeated the entire 3 days was remote ID. And we heard over and over again how remote ID is really kind of pacing almost anything. We're not going to have drone delivery without remote ID. We're not going to have UTM. We're not going to have urban air mobility. There's a lot of these things that are really hinging on remote ID. So that's got a real focus from the FAA, and I can talk some more about that in a little bit.
But let's talk about the important things. How are the luncheons?
Oh, David.
Come on, we got to have some fun with this.
So here's what they did for the luncheons. The luncheons were plenary sessions, so there was a panel for each lunch session in the ballroom, in the main ballroom. And what they did is outside of the ballroom, they had basically boxed lunches with different, you know, sandwiches, basically, of different flavors.
Which were really good when I was there.
Yeah, you had the same setup?
Yeah.
The nice thing was, you know, a buffet takes a long time. This is a great way to do it. You can just grab a box, go back into the ballroom, take a seat, eat your lunch, and listen to the speakers, to the panels. They also had an interesting way, and I don't know if they did this last time, David, with you, an interesting way of collecting questions from the audience. They used a service, so you would get on your, you know, on your phone and go to a certain web page, and you would enter your questions there. And then the moderator would have a tablet and could see these questions.
No, that's new. That's pretty cool.
That was pretty effective. That was pretty something that I think others who are organizing events like this could maybe take a look at. But we had some good speakers. Dan Elwell, the acting FAA administrator, was there. He talked about joining the National Airspace System is about safety, not technology. He viewed the registration numbers on drones as kind of equivalent to a physical license plate, the remote ID equivalent to an electronic license plate. I asked a question about the NPRM. Remember, David, we talked about the remote ID NPRM got moved from July to, September. And the reason for that is because under the FAA reauthorization, there were, as we've talked about, there were changes to the recreational drone sections of that. And so they need to kind of go back and see how that influences the, you know, the NPRM for remote ID. So that's why that push out. Elwell made an interesting comment. He said, together, and there really was a strong theme of togetherness, industry and the regulators. He said, together we are making history in real time, which I think is, which is true. But on remote ID, more work is needed to develop standards, but that's not the end of it. There is an infrastructure that needs to be built out. And the FAA is envisioning this as coming from UAS service providers following the LANCE model, right? Same basic idea. You know, you have service providers that contribute towards the infrastructure that would allow remote ID. But that's not the end of it either. Then after that, you've got the rulemaking. And the FAA said that was a very high priority. DJI's Brendan Schulman was there, and he pointed out that remote ID needs to be free or, at worst, very low cost. Otherwise, people are disincented to comply, which was kind of an interesting concept. Out of another session, there were conversations about remote ID and network congestion. With the great number of drones that may be flying around needing to be ID'd for all these different purposes, our network's going to be able to handle that. So that was an issue that came up. Also, privacy of the operator. This is one I hadn't thought of. If you can identify the drone and where it's flying or other data concerning the drone, then that tells you something about the operator. And at first you might think, well, that's good, but not always. I mean, even for aircraft, right, David, some business aircraft, their registrations are blocked.
Right. They have their ADS-B blocked.
Because they may be going off to negotiate a deal that's not public and certainly not known by its competitors. So there may be sort of similar privacy issues with remote ID. But then you had speakers like CNN was there, and CNN said, we need remote ID yesterday. They described a situation where there was a news event or an event being covered by news services. And CNN, of course, had their drone there, but, you know, so did the local TV stations, a number of others. And it became a problem with all these drones up in the air covering this event. And, of course, no system for preventing interaction other than just visual at this point. Another topic that came up, or a question that came up, was concerning the DHS advisory about Chinese drones.
Oh, I'm sure Brandon had something to say about that.
He did. He said that they've been working with the government to establish and meet data requirements. He also says, we, that being DJI, we have no interest in data. That's a quote from him. He said that they want to make hardware, not collect data. He also said, and this is also a quote, DJI is in alignment with DHS. So that's how that was addressed. Another topic, education and outreach. This came out a lot. We obviously have talked quite a bit about folks who are using drones from time to time in ways that are really not proper. It was announced that later this year, and we don't really have any details of this yet, but later this year there's going to be a Drone Aviation Safety Week, and that's going to be a big push to educate, make people aware, that sort of thing. So I think that's a good idea.
So, Max, you're talking about all of the seminars. What was the general consent? Did you get to talk to other people? What was maybe, let's just talk a little few minutes about what was the sentiment for the attendees, not just the FAA?
Well, I think that, there were different kinds of reactions. I think generally very positive. Everybody that I talked to about the symposium as a whole was very complimentary of the event. There were some kind of, subtopics maybe, or where they might have some kind of differences of opinion. Urban air mobility was one of them, perhaps. There was a lot of enthusiasm. I mean, Bell was there, Uber was there. There was a lot of enthusiasm for urban air mobility, air taxis, if you want to call them that, or whatever they end up being called or how they're being characterized. And we listened to some descriptions of some interesting ways to approach managing the air traffic at different levels. But there was a little bit of skepticism here and there that I encountered about autonomous variants of these. Now, it seems like everybody who's talking about urban air mobility and investing company dollars in developing that seems to be looking at manned aircraft at the beginning, with then the hope of ultimately making those autonomous. And there was some skepticism amongst some of the people that I talked to, not all of them, but some of the people, as to whether that was really going to happen. Similarly with self-driving cars, because there's a lot of overlap kind of in the autonomy area there. But I think the mood generally, I think, David, to answer your question, was really positive. Maybe a greater understanding of why the pace of this is what it is and why it's not faster. I think that as the discussions unfolded, they weren't negative from the standpoint of, we can't do this, we can't do this, we can't do that, we can't do the other thing, or we don't know how to do this. It was more on the lines of, okay, we have these challenges, so let's figure out how to do this together, industry and government, the regulators. And I think people had a pretty good appreciation, if they didn't already, that the pace is what it needs to be, because as we heard over and over, safety is the priority here. We're not going to do anything that's not safe.
Well, that's important, and I'm glad to see the FAA is sticking with the theme, because when I was there, it was, we need your help. The FAA reaching out to the public and industry itself. I did get a strange text message the other day from you. It took me a couple of few minutes to figure out what you were saying. You learned how to pronounce a new word, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. So, beyond visual line of sight, I've always said BVLOS, but nobody there said BVLOS. They said BV loss.
Well, but when you get a text message that says B as in the animal, loss, I'm going, what the hell is he talking about? With no other context. So from now on, we will say BV loss and not BVLOS.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was the oddest takeaway you came away with?
The oddest takeaway?
Or what was something that surprised you the most?
A couple of things. One is the vision, particularly amongst the network providers, the communication services, Verizon and AT&T and those, that 5G could play a major role in these areas with drones, and similarly with self-driving cars. 5G has very small latency compared to LTE, what we generally use now. And so the point was made is if you have an aircraft flying or a car driving down the highway and sensors detect something, or there's some information that causes it to be necessary to redirect the vehicle or the aircraft or whatever. I mean, you need to be able to react quickly. And if you're connected to a network to get the data and the network doesn't give you instant results, you're not going to react fast enough. So everybody's high on 5G latency. 5G, though, I don't think this is anything that we're going to see for years and years, because 5G has a much shorter range than LTE, unless we increase the power of the transmitters, which that's not going to happen because that means your cell phone batteries wouldn't last so long. We need a lot more towers in order to support a 5G network, and I really wonder personally whether those towers are going to show up in more places than around urban areas. So I think you're going to have some holes. But there is a recognition that, you know, while 5G would be really great for this kind of autonomy, that, we need a system that works without it and without connectivity. So that was interesting.
What I just thought about was, what? Great, 5G, we need more towers, more obstacles to fly around, so we need 5G, which will cause more towers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have one bar at my house, and at my mother's house, she has no bars. So the hope of seeing more towers sprout around us so that we can have 5G, it just doesn't seem realistic to me. But
I don't know. The bar at my house has scotch and tequila and Jim Beam. You only need one bar, right?
All right.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, you're talking about something. Sorry, folks, I need to chime in. I'm not giving him a break from talking. So
counter UAV, counter UAV, David. There were some interesting things there. Do you know that previously only the DOD, the Department of Defense, and the Department of Energy had the statutory ability to employ or deploy counter UAV technology? Now with the reauthorization, Department of Homeland Security and the DOJ, Department of Justice, now they can as well. But all this is only in certain specific circumstances where they can take a drone out. There are some considerations. It has to be an illegal activity. But the FAA is very concerned about counter UAV in that they want to be sure that if you're flying lawfully, that you don't have to worry about or you don't have to be concerned about some kind of interdiction by some agency that thinks you're doing something improper. They're also worried that there could easily be an overreaction to a drone incident that, in fact, doesn't really pose a safety threat. So they're looking, to be very careful about not, over-deploying this stuff. Now, airports can implement detection systems, but they can't take drones down. But in order to implement a detection system, an airport has to follow basically the same process that an airport has to follow whenever they add a new system into their airport operations. But it gets even more tricky because of, and this was a surprise, something I hadn't realized or thought of, surveillance and privacy laws. There are very specific laws about snooping, about intercepting transmissions. And it can be very easy to be at odds with that. So from an airport's standpoint right now, like a Gatwick, well, in the U.S. anyway. By following some processes, they could implement drone detection systems, but that's as far as they can go.
Makes you wonder, okay, you detected it, then what do you do?
Well, they can't. Only the DOD, the DOE, the DHS, and the DOJ could potentially do something. But, you know, how fast are they going to get there, and do they have the right tools? There was a comment that during the whole Gatwick situation where they moved, I guess, military drone detection and remediation equipment into the area, we were told that a lot of that stuff, it didn't work. So we're not there with the technology yet.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, this was Gatwick, and that's still been a kind of a giant mystery.
Yeah.
But interesting that, you know, counter UAS is not as evidently not as far along as we thought there was, you know, that I keep saying that this was going to be the year of the CUAS, but clearly there's other issues besides that.
There are. Now, there's a Blue Ribbon Task Force that was created. It's called the Blue Ribbon Task Force on UAS Mitigation at Airports. And it was commissioned just this year by AUVSI and ACINA, Airports Council International, I guess, I think that is. There's a website. It's UASmitigationAtAirports.org. So if this is, you know, if you're an airport operator or you're interested in learning more about this, that's one place you can start. Michael Huerta is co-chair of that, as well as Deborah Flint. And the members of that Blue Ribbon Task Force include folks like John Pistol, the former TSA administrator, but also a lot of different airlines, airports. NATCA, the Air Traffic Association, is represented there.
And again, Max, we weren't invited.
You know who was invited, though, was the NFL. The senior VP of security for the NFL is part of that, too, which I think that's great because, you know, there's a mitigation at airports, mitigation at big sporting events. It's sort of the same thing.
Think about what we talked about this year's Super Bowl. It was a lot of people flying drones, and there was a lot of arrests. So,
and it took a lot of effort because that was brought up as well. There were a huge number of agencies at the, you know, federal, state, local level that had to collaborate in order to do that. And I think we talked about or wondered about how, you know, the drones were apprehended, you know, the pilots were apprehended. And the answer was it was boots on the ground. So you can use technology to identify, you know, errant drones, if you will, rogue drones. But as of right now, basically, you can, you know, use that information to try to pinpoint maybe what the source is. But then you've got to send folks out there to try to apprehend the operator of the drone. So it's not so easy.
But someday will come that they will realize that you and I have the answers to everything.
Well, I'm not sure about that, David. There's some pretty complicated issues. You know who I saw there was Ken Krantz, our friend Ken. He's on the UAS safety team. And actually, we may have Ken and maybe a few others from the team come on at some point in the near future and talk to us about this. One of the things they're doing is building a reporting system that's modeled after the NASA ASRS system. You know what that system is, David, right?
Yes.
The Aviation Safety Reporting System. The idea there is that we want to encourage pilots and I guess others to report unsafe situations,
practices,
or incidents, practices.
Events.
Right.
But most of all,
yep,
it's anonymous.
Exactly. And so they're basically building kind of an equivalent for reporting drone incidents. And in fact, if I heard Ken correctly, I think they're even using the NASA ASRS server. So, they're hosting it off the same thing.
How about UTM, Max? Anything on that?
That came out in a couple of different ways. And in fact, that was another kind of a comment that I got from some of the other attendees, was that there are a number of people who are working on that. And Some of them say that they've got it figured out, but everybody recognizes, I think, that we can't have this collection of UTM systems that are, you know, all different and not integrated, and there should be at least some degree of harmony across countries, let alone within a country. So that takes some work. There is a, Embraer was there. In fact, was he the president or the CEO? I forget. But Embraer, of course, is working with Uber to produce at some point a flying taxi. And Embraer has a white paper that proposes some methods to handle this issue of traffic management. One concept that was talked about is a single drone on a particular mission may actually switch between protocols, I guess you'd call them, depending on the situation. So, for example, we currently have VFR and we have IFR, and maybe there's a UTM somewhere in the middle for, you know, those kinds of vehicles and drone deliveries and things like that. So maybe you've got a kind of a VFR equivalent for drones below 400 feet, something, you know, in between for, kind of commercial operation. And, maybe there would be different systems, different protocols for those different degrees of need for traffic management. And perhaps a single drone on a mission could, switch between those depending on the environment that they are presented with. We'll put some links in the show notes to some of these efforts here. The Blue Ribbon Task Force is at UASmitigation@airports.org. The Embraer white paper titled Flight Plan 2030, that's interesting. It's at flightplan2030.com. And that comes from Embraer X. If you're wondering, organizationally, where's Embraer on this? Embraer X is kind of their disruptive technologies group. And they're working on some really, really interesting things.
So, Max, any good swag?
No, because there were not exhibitors, right? There's no exhibit hall. It's not like some of the other, unmanned aviation events where you've got companies exhibiting. Yeah, none.
No, I know. It's just business. I'm teasing. But
although I did get a couple of good things from the FAA.
Yeah, you got stickers.
They were passing out little stickers for affixing to your drone that are handy for noting the your registration number. But they have some other interesting handouts. There's a Lance handout and some other things as well. They have some good literature. The FAA has a lot of webinars and things of that sort online that are available for people. They really have developed quite a lot of resources to try to do as much by way of awareness as they can. So I'm hoping that this Drone Aviation Safety Week that we'll be hearing more about as we progress towards the end of the year, I'm hoping that that will provide some good opportunities for all of us, maybe, to get engaged in helping others understand, drones and what's good drone behavior and what's not.
Well, Max, you had your first aviation symposium. It sounds like you had the same awesome time that I did and learned a lot. Kind of mind-blowing, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would strongly recommend that anybody who's involved in concepts of commercial use of drones would want to attend the next one in the future, because it really is an opportunity to learn a lot, as you said, David, but also to have face time with the major players that are involved on both sides, the regulators, the FAA folks, as well as others in industry. So it's a really, really good way, I think, to understand just exactly where we are, what we need to do, where we're going. There was one final comment, maybe, or almost final comment, David, is that at one point, somebody on a panel asked the audience to raise their hands, everyone who had commented on a particular NPRM in the past. And some hands went up, but it was a relatively small number of people in the audience. And so several times we heard from some of the speakers, some of the panelists, that it really is very important that those in the unmanned aircraft industry actively contribute to these NPRMs and ANPRM also in some cases, because the FAA, the regulators can't do this by themselves. And they, you know, they need the input from industry, from the thinkers, from the stakeholders in this industry. So, I mean, we've said it before, David, but it was really reiterated several times there. And I think we should continue to encourage our listeners to contribute their comments and their thoughts when these things come out. It's very important.
I'd like to thank the FAA and AUVSI for giving you the opportunity. We've made very good contacts with both organizations, and it's really cool that we can bring you this information so that you don't necessarily have to go to Baltimore. Though I would have gone and got out and gotten crab legs, but
I think it's a good season for crabs this year in the Chesapeake Bay there.
But Max, thanks for going. Glad you learned a lot. And we can take away this stuff going forward.
Yeah, and I think we'll have a few interviews from some of the people, some of the contacts that I made. I'm particularly looking forward to bringing someone from Embraer X on the show. We've also made some good contacts with Precision Hawk, who has been involved in many of these industry/regulator groups, and in fact are playing a very major role in helping form the thoughts that are going to lead to the rules that we'll all be operating under in the future. So yeah, I'm expecting us to have some great content for all of you listening in the not too distant future. All right, David, I could probably talk for about another half hour, but that's probably enough for now. So maybe we should wrap it up.
I think we'll wrap it up. One last thing: a week from Saturday, we will be down in the Smithsonian at the Innovations of Flight Day talking. Hopefully we'll have some UAS stuff come out of that, but stop by. Max and I like seeing all of our listeners, Airplane Geek listeners and UAV Digest listeners. So if you want that information, you can join our Slack listener team, and that would be send us an email to feedback@theuavdigest.com, and we'll send you that information. You want to tell us how they can find the show notes?
Yeah, you can find us, of course, at the UAVDigest.com. You can find the show notes for this episode at the UAVDigest.com/290. We'll also have a link to that event David mentioned at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum. That's June 15th. That's a Saturday. And it's at the Stephen S. Uvar Hazy Center, which is in Northern Virginia, right adjacent to Dulles Airport. They call it a family day, and it is. They have a lot of activities. It's one of those kinds of events and one of those kinds of venues where if you bring family members who maybe aren't as passionate about aviation as you might be, but they'll have a great time. There's a lot of things to do and see there. So hopefully we'll see you there. David, how can they find us on social media?
You can find us on Twitter at UAV Digest. You can find us on Facebook. And of course, you can find us on our Slack listener team. Like I said, we want you to join that and have some fun. You can do that by sending us an email at feedback@theuavdigest.com. And of course, listen to us every Friday. So with that, I'm going to say this is David in Fort Washington.
And Max back in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.